All right. I think if I've done this correctly. Kristen, are you still there?
I'm here.
I'm here.
And Sonny Osborne, you're there.
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, man. All right. I'm sorry. Sometimes it gets difficult to connect everybody up, but I think we've finally done it. So
we are going worldwide, ain't we?
We are worldwide, buddy. We are worldwide. Probably out into the galaxy, too. I think at some point the signal just picks up escape velocity and just keeps on going, so you're everywhere.
You know, before the world was invented and all that stuff, what was there then?
The singularity. I don't know. These are the wrong conversations. We can't talk about these things on this show. We can do this at lunch, but we can't do this now. Well, you probably, Sonny, you probably weren't listening, but we were just gushing about you.
Oh, really?
I'm embarrassed for you, yeah.
Well, I get a lot of things I don't deserve. You know, but like I said before, I've got arthritis, and I don't reserve that neither. So,
oh, man. Well, we were talking, Kristen and I were talking about, of course, the new album that the Grascals have, which, you know, as she said, you know, the composition of the band, they always go back and dip into that Osborne Brothers library. And they did a really nice job on Bluegrass Melodies, I thought. I'm sure you've heard that, but it's really nice.
I thought it was just tremendous. I've heard a few records of that, and this is that's the best one yet. It's very, very good, very good. And I'm glad they did it. It helps us the radio.
Well, it's a great...
It helps me anyway, mentally.
Helps you mentally?
Yeah, it helps me mentally. Well, let's see. Somebody talk a minute. I need to think.
Okay. All right. Well, Kristen and I will think about something to ask you while you're thinking.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I know what it was. Wait. I got what it was.
He's got it. All right. This is where I just sit back.
I meant to butt in there, by the way. Anyway, Kristen, do you know that thing that you put on Larry Stevenson's record of me and my old banjo that you came out here and went over and over and over? Where did we hear that from?
No, I don't know. You're confused because I never came over. I came over and got the Granada, but we didn't do the lick. You dreamed the lick, and you called me the next day after I had gotten the Granada, and you hummed it to me over the phone. That's how that lick came about. She said, I got this lick. And we weren't together when we were working it out. You were humming it to me on the phone, and I played it just over and over until you said that was right. And in an effort, I'm not a tab reader at all, but I can write tab pretty well if it's something that I know. And to try to remember it, I tabbed it, and you said, that is exactly what I heard. That's right. Of course, the record comes out, and you hear it, and you said, that's not right.
No, there's one strain.
I'm
off.
Shocked.
You added a strain on me, so that makes it yours.
Yeah, that little thing there.
Are you sure that?
I love this.
I haven't recorded that somewhere.
What is it now?
Are you sure I didn't record that somewhere?
Yeah, no, I'm really sure about that. Now, we did, one time, we did work on the, together at your house, we worked on the Listen to the Rain licks from the Once More albums. We did try to figure that out, because there was one that I could not figure out, and actually, you couldn't either that day. We went over and over it, and you couldn't remember it, and I just couldn't figure it out, and then a few days later, you remember I told you I was doing it, and it just happened. I just played it, and it was like, oh, my gosh, it just kind of happened. So I do remember doing that with the backup licks from Listening to the Rain.
That's the one that goes down and then back up, isn't it?
That's Listening to the Rain, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, I'm sure that it's recorded somewhere.
Yeah. You told me that you had it in your head, but you never could get it in there or something. You never could incorporate it into the song, or but you would have it in your mind.
I'll be darned. Okay.
Yeah, so the only recording of it that I know of is the wrong one that I did.
Well, that makes it right.
I have never heard Sonny. This is a first for me, so I have to break in here because I've never heard Sonny say, "Okay, I didn't record that tune," because Sonny knows every note that he ever recorded. So this to me is a breakthrough point for you, Sonny, I think.
I thought sure I had, or done it on a live show somewhere or something. But see now, if I were to, I can't play anymore. But if I were to come out and record it now the right way, it would then, to everybody that listens to it, it would be the wrong way because you did it first.
No, that wouldn't work that way. It still doesn't work that way when you're Sonny and Kristen. Whether I did it first, it'd still go your direction, I'm sure.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so because it's not written anywhere that I told you how to do that or told you to do that or anything. It's not written down anywhere, so there's no proof of that.
Yeah, well, you know, Ben Surratt was recording and producing that record, and he just looped it, that section, and let me do it over and over to try to, I tried to make it kind of greasy, you know, not really the way that I try to execute things normally. I tried to make it kind of Sonny-like as much as I could. And what we had, you know, I really felt like it was going to be right. Now you could absolutely have recorded it in the past, and I've just never heard it. You can tell me that you had, but there very well could be, you know how that is. I mean, I'll play a loop that I'll think, maybe, did I come up with that, or usually not. But I'll be, and then I'll hear a live show of somebody, and it'll be like, oh, that's from that, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, I want to ask you, too, what is the new album that you guys have out? What is it?
When I Get My Pay is the name of it.
Yeah, is that the one where you got dirt and coal dust all over you?
Yeah.
This is so weird, because that's the first thing I talked about,
too. Why do they put coal dust and dirt and stuff all over you?
Well, it's not coal dust or dirt. It's makeup.
I know that, but it's he sold us.
No.
Freaking back.
Well,
and you know, at your size, you're not going to work faster than mine.
I know. Yeah, especially in downtown Nashville, right? No, the idea for that was Janie's idea. You know, the famous picture of the guys, I think they're building the Rockefeller building in like the 30s, and they're on the steel beam. And he just sort of wanted to copy that. And, boy, you can really mess up when you try to do something that iconic. But the overall idea came from that. And we didn't try to copy it, but they did put, instead of New York City in the background, it's Nashville. We're just sitting there like we've been working, like any of us. Hey, we all work. We just don't get dirty when we do it. But it's pushing the records through the mud to the CD table.
Or is it good?
It is good.
The record, well, you heard it. You heard a not finished version, but you heard a version.
Well, I meant after the mix and all that stuff.
Yeah, right. Yeah, in fact, I'll give you, if I see you today, I'll give you one. But it just came out, and I think they did good. You know, you always, Steve, I'm sure you feel this way too. You always wonder how all that post-production stuff is gonna affect things, and the mixing and the mastering. Because sometimes it can make it great, and it can not be great. And you just kind of cross your fingers. And the people that we worked with, Van Atkins is the engineer at the record label Mountain Home, and he did such a great job. And then I think he was pretty much in charge of everything, the mix and the mastering. I thought it turned out good. It pretty much stayed the same, which I think it should be everyone's goal, is to kind of preserve what you did and just don't mess with it. Just present it. This is what happened.
Well, you know, one of the worst things as a mastering engineer or a mixing engineer or just an engineer or a sound man. They're all in the same boat usually. But if people would just be calm and let everybody just be normal, it would be a lot better. But they won't do that because then they feel they're not doing their job. I think, anyway, that's the way it is. And a mastering engineer can really destroy a record.
Wreck a record.
We had a thing on MGM. It was an instrumental album, I think it was. And then another thing was cutting grass or one of those things. I can't remember exactly which one, but it was totally destroyed because they were just learning how to do stereo, and the guy really didn't know how to do it, and he didn't know bluegrass music to begin with. And
that's always dangerous, too.
He just really messed it up bad. When the banjo would be supposed to be playing, the mandolin rhythm would come up. I mean, it was just really bad. And on TV shows, it's the same thing. I know that a lot of times Bobby would be singing, and they'd have a picture of me playing the banjo, or vice versa, or whatever. And when the mandolin break come on, they show the fiddler. I have had more, I mean, almost fights with people, cameramen, engineers and sound men.
I don't believe this
like
part.
But you can't
I've
do
heard
it.
About some of those.
I have not. This is all. This is all new to me, and I'm questioning the reliability here of these stories of Sonny almost in fights. I just can't. I can't fathom it.
Yeah, you can picture it.
I wouldn't fight. I mean, as far as that goes, I wouldn't fist fight with anybody because I just don't believe that's the way to do things. But I have verbally, very sternly, verbally abused people.
Listen to him dance around. See, he expects me to come in and say, as your lawyer, I would advise you not. But see, I'm not doing that. He's just out there on his own right now.
Sonny, I'm actually curious about something. You were talking about the NCA records. Were you not already large enough to just veto that? Like, was it just different back then, and you would have heard it back and said, no, that's not good. That's not how it's going out.
Yeah, on MCA, yeah, but not on MGM. We didn't know what was going on with MGM. We were just happy to be there, and if we'd had any brains, we had every right to be there when they mixed it and when it was mastered. We had every right to be there, and we had every right also, as every musician does, to say, no, I want this guy to mix it, and I want that guy to master it. But a lot of people are just so enthused with, oh, my goodness, I'm getting a record out, that they'll do anything. And I didn't learn that until the mid-60s sometime. In the 50s, though, I had no idea. I didn't, you know, just like I just said, we were just happy to be there. And we also sold 11,000 records of everything that MGM made. And so that means one thing. We were a write-off. That's what we were. But, you know, we became established during that time, and that helped us a lot later on. But we were neither one anyways too smart when it came to that side of the business. We didn't know anything about it, but we learned.
Well, by the end, I mean you had your hand on every single aspect of all of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Bobby owned the studio and all the mics. We could use any mic that we wanted to use, what we wanted to use. And a lot of times we would go into studios and say, okay, I need a Neumann U87 here. Oh, we don't have that kind of microphone. And so a lot of times we'd have to settle for just whatever they had. But we wound up we owned between 95 and 100% of everything we did. And that, to me, that's the secret of the whole business, is to own as much of yourself as you can. David Houston one time and I were talking. David was really big, too. I mean, real. He was really big. And we were talking, and we figured out that he actually owned about 30% of himself. When everything came out, percentages, this and this and this and this, and managers and road managers and people like that that was just draining everything that he made. He made about 30 cents on every dollar that he took in. And so I decided right then and there at the time what we needed to do was own as much of ourselves as we possibly could. And we wound up owning between 95 and 100%. So you can't get any better than that.
Yeah.
Hey, Sonny, let me ask you something. Before you came on, Kristen was talking about that. And by the way, if you just tuned in, we're talking to Kristen Scott Benson, and now we have Sonny Osborne on the line. She was talking. I asked Kristen about her her initial contact with you and her influences from you and her relationship with you. And I want the people to hear the flip side of Sonny Osborne meeting and hearing Kristen's playing and your involvement with her development.
Well, the first time I remember seeing Kristen was she was about 18, I guess, and working with Larry Stevenson, and we had played a show in Michigan at some little dumb festival. It was really bad. It was just a terrible thing. We had a huge crowd of probably 13, maybe 14 people. And Larry came and told, I knew Larry, and he came and told me that he would like for me to hear her play and to say something to her like, that's good playing and all like that. And I refused to do that, although I did hear her play, and her playing was, and it's always been, immaculate. I mean, I told her the other day, I have never, not one time, and I've known her since she was 18, I have never heard her miss a note. Not one. And she says, well, I've missed enough. Well, that's for sure. We all have, but I've never heard her miss one. But, and the relationship with Kristen is that she is probably, and Kristen, you close your ears off now.
I know, this is the yeah.
You didn't have to hear it.
she's probably the most honest person that I guess I've ever met. I mean, I only know three or four people that I completely trust and that I know is honest and absolute straight, and she's one of them. And so that's about the best I can do.
It's high praise.
And I love her like a dog.
Yeah. Oh, that's the one I love.
I knew that was coming.
Yeah. If I had another daughter, I would want her to be like Kristen.
There you go.
For sure.
Yeah, that'll make anybody feel good.
Oh.
I told Jamie Johnson the other night that in their band, I had two sons, a daughter, and two brothers.
you're talking about the Grascals as they're made up now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Grascals band, yeah.
Explain a little bit while you're talking about that. From the Osborne brothers, who left and became part of what we know as the Grascals now, just so everybody listens and understands.
Terry Smith and Terry Eldridge worked with us 12 and 13 years. And then I've explained about Kristen. Mm-hmm. And then Jamie Johnson and Danny. I can't remember that guy's name. But they're like brothers to me. I mean, they really are. And I love that whole bunch, though. They're just really good, honest people. And the two Terrys are I'm afraid to say anything bad about them.
they've got a lot of dirt on you, don't they, Sonny?
They know too much.
They know a lot, yeah. And you know, Sonny is the reason that I got the job with the Grascals. That's, you know, yet another thing he did for me. I called about the job, but that wouldn't have mattered. What mattered is that he called. Which one did you call, Terry Eldridge or Smith?
I called Smitty first.
Smitty, mm-hmm. And just said, you know, consider this as absolutely the reason that I got hired.
It's his thing, because I called Smitty and I told him about Kristen, and he said, you know, I never thought about that. And I said, well, you need to think about it, because I said, she is a great banjo player and will fit in just perfectly with what you guys do. And he said, I never thought about that. And then I talked to Jamie about it, too, and they decided, and they made a great decision, too. They couldn't have made a better one, I'll put it that way, not to fit what they do. She's just a great banjo player and has won that banjo award from IBMA for 4 years in a row. She won it. So that ain't chopped liver.
That ain't chopped liver. I thought they might rename it after her after a while.
It should be the Kristen Benson and the, what was that, Jerry Douglas won about 16 times in a row.
Rob Ike has, I think, actually.
Oh, you're right, on Dobro.
Yeah, yep. I'm not kidding. I think he has maybe won that much. It feels like it anyway.
I know one thing, Jerry Douglas had won it, I think his sixth or seventh time, and when he accepted the award, he said, you know, this is getting boring. And I mean, the whole industry.
How did that go for him? Did that go okay? Feeling bad? Yeah, there he is. Figures.
That did not go at all. And he had to apologize.
Oh, I know what he's saying. I mean, he's so great. He was probably just like, let's spread this around. I'm sure he didn't mean anything by it.
I know what he was saying, but I mean,
yeah,
he shouldn't have said it like that. He just said, the winner is Jerry Douglas, and then he came up on the stage and got the award. He said, you know, this is getting boring.
Oh, jeez.
And the industry came down on him. I mean, they really did.
Don't ever do that. Don't ever do that, Kristen, when you start winning another four or five in a row.
I was going to say, it never got boring. I don't think I'm going to have that problem.
Well, I don't know. A lot of people put a lot of faith in awards and all that stuff. I never did. I never did appreciate the whole system, and I still don't. And the only thing that I accepted, and we won a bunch of awards, but the only thing that I ever accepted was that entrance into the Bluegrass Hall of Fame. I was there that night and spoke and all that. I was proud to do it, but the rest of that stuff, that's just... Al Lubin told me one time, he said, you know, awards are good for one thing, that's to break a lot of hearts. Well, that's about the truth.
Well, you know, I heard one of the best things that I thought, wow, that is so great. I heard John Mayer one time, they said, how's it feel to have, you know, the best-selling record in America? And he said, this week or whatever, and he said, well, it means that more people bought my record than anyone else, but it doesn't mean it's good. And I thought that's absolutely the right perspective. I know exactly where I stand musically, and winning or not winning an award has absolutely no bearing on the musician you are. You know, it doesn't change what you can do a bit.
It's a popularity contest is what it is. And if you look good and follow the lines and all that stuff, you'll win those things. I mean, you can politic and win awards all you want to, but Steve's namesake, Steve Walker, proved that being a good banjo player, well, never mind, I'm not going to go into that. Anyway.
Thank you.
I'm out in left field. I don't know where we're going now.
We'll just let it lie.
We'll leave that for all. I would get way in over my head there, and I'd need a lawyer.
Yeah.
I might anyway.
You need a lawyer.
Well, I'm curious, though, Sonny, like you say, those awards, the CMA, when you guys did Vocal Group of the Year, I mean, that was a huge deal for a bluegrass band to win that. Did you really see a giant difference, and did it affect your careers positively? Because one thing I've noticed, and it doesn't matter so much like if it's an instrumental award, it's just a person, but even for bands, I'm actually surprised at the lack of impact that that big things can happen sometimes. Like you can win, say you win Entertainer of the Year, or you know, you get to the Atlanta or something like that, and you hope it'll be, you know, a push. And the bottom line is, you still have to call the promoters, you still have to get booked, you still have to drive the bus there. You know, it just seems like the grind continues on, and those things are nice, but I never can quite connect tangibly the effect that anything like that has for bands. Did the big Vocal Group of the Year award, was that a huge shot in the arm for you guys?
Not one bit. We were
not one bit. Yeah.
We were in the top five Vocal Groups of the Year for 6 years in a row, and we won in 1971, and then we also won the Bluegrass Band of the Year from 1970 to 1980, and I couldn't tell that it meant one thing. One, it didn't. I don't know of a date that it got for us. Not one.
Yeah, and that's what it comes down to for Bluegrass Band. Such a, you know, nickel and dime kind of quantity of dates type of living, you know, and you want to shoot for 80 dates, or you want to shoot for 100 dates or whatever, and that's really the lifeblood. It's not tied to, I mean, it all helps, but it's not tied to airplay or having massive hits that reach, you know, mainstream audiences. It's this niche that we've got within the bluegrass box, and you just have to work that system, and the system doesn't seem to be affected very much by any of that.
The awards, no, it doesn't affect it. To me, it never affected anything. What really had a major effect on our career was, number one, the Grand Ole Opry, and then number two was the con job that was done to get our records played on country radio stations. That helped.
So, see, airplay did help you guys a lot.
Immensely, yeah. And we did it simply by adding electric instruments. And at that time, a lot of pop stations were going country, and they hired music directors and program directors who really didn't know what country music was. And they identified with steel, and electric guitar, piano, and drums. So we thought to ourselves, you know what? What we'll do is add those things to our music. And we did, and it worked. They started playing our records. And once they played them, and we were blessed to have the best vocal guy that ever lived, my brother. And so with the combination of that stuff, like, it really worked for us. And we went from working, 30 days or 35, 40 days a year to at sometimes 200 and 250, 270 days a year.
Yeah, I remember you saying the time that you would come home and Judy wouldn't even have time to wash your clothes.
No. Well, I remember one period we went through where I think it was 43 straight days, one-nighters too. 43, came home for, I think, 3 days. And then left for 22 or 23 more, and we really worked hard because we were broke so long, and we appreciated and wanted everything that we could get, and so we worked hard and took a lot of days that we probably shouldn't have, but we had a lot of fun doing it, and I wouldn't take nothing for the experience that I got from that and the education I got from that. But I think I'd trade it all for a really solid, good education.
Yeah, you have always held on to that. Ever since I've known you, that's been a big thing that seems to really matter to you. It certainly mattered with your kids.
It does. Yeah, it really did. I didn't want them to play music because it's too bad. It's just a bad business to be in, I think, in my mind. A lot of people look at the glory and all like that. Yeah, that's all good. And the awards and all that stuff. And people recognize you when you go to Walmart or Kroger or something like that. But I never did like that. I never liked that. That's the worst part of the whole thing as far as I was concerned. And I always
regret. Most of us don't have to worry about that.
Well, But I regret that I didn't get a good education. If I had gotten that, I think life would have been a whole lot easier because, but you know, with a good education don't teach you 2 and 2 is 4 or who discovered whatever. That's not the point. It teaches you how to think. It teaches you how to get from point A to point B in a straight line and not go 50 miles east and west trying to get there. And that, without being able to think clearly, that's what you do.
And you figured all that out, without it.
Yeah, but it took me probably 4 times as long to do it, too. And so that's where I really needed that education that I didn't get. But I don't have any regrets. The music business was really good to me. And we were always, whenever our number was called, we were always just standing there waiting. And a lot of people, they're not that lucky or they don't figure it out or something. But yeah. We were always there and we got the good deals. We really did. We got a good record contract. We got the Grand Ole Opry. We got simply because we figured out how to do it. And so there you go.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about how hard you guys worked, and you absolutely did. But if you get the opportunity to work hard, that is such a blessing in itself, that just getting the opportunity to work that hard, because so many people would.
Yeah.
If they had the chance. Now, you do have to do it, and you still get the credit for doing it, but it's a blessing that you get the chance to do it.
The opportunity, yeah. If the opportunity comes, you need to be there waiting to get it.
And not just that. I mean, Sonny, I've heard you do this discussion. You just happened to be there, but you also had to deliver when the opportunity came up, and you guys always did.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. But we had the talent, and we did things that nobody else was doing. And like I said before, we had probably the best bluegrass, if not the best vocal guy in his field to ever live. And that helps, you know. You know, you can take and have a banjo player just completely outstanding, or a mandolin player, or a fiddle player, and somebody has been there already and gone with that. Somebody. Whether it be Jethro Burns or Homer, or Earl, or whomever, it doesn't matter. But they couldn't, nobody could duplicate Bobby. They just couldn't duplicate what he was doing, and they never will be able to. Because he just, that song you christened, it's just something about you, well, it's just something about him. That's just different.
Yeah. Didn't you say that you told him that you were going to get you guys to the Grand Ole Opry and that he was going to keep you there? I always took that quote as, hey, I'm going to do anything behind the scenes, whatever needs to happen. I'm going to just promote us in any way I need to get us there. And then once they hear you sing, we'll stay. And that's pretty much what happened, right?
I told him, this was in the 50s. I said, you stick with me and I'll get you on the Grand Ole Opry, and it's up to you to keep us there.
Yeah.
And he did.
He did, yeah.
He's amazing vocal. I just wonder if he'd been vocally trained. I mean, you know, I wonder what he could have done with his voice, but it was pretty good the way it was.
But you know, though, Sonny, really, if you think about maybe formal training, it might have restricted where you guys went. Because Kristen and I spent a lot of time talking about things that you just made up, a whole cloth, your backup, and things you did from different instruments. And I just sometimes wonder if a formal training might have put some limits on where you were willing to go.
Maybe. I'm not sure about that. I'd have to think about that some. I think maybe that might be... I know one thing, we'd have never played Louisiana, Kentucky. I had lunch, I guess it was last week or week before last, with Kenny Ingram and Larry Stevenson, and we were talking about playing Bad Dates, and our group and Flats' group, Lester Flats, Nashville Grass group, played at Louisiana, Kentucky. I swear there were 7 people in the audience. We had 7. I mean, seven people.
I think that's where Larry Cordell's from. Isn't that his hometown?
I don't know if it is Luisi, though. That's the only time. And whoever was booking us before I started putting it, I told them, I said, don't ever put us there again. Never. And that's the only time we ever played Luisi, Kentucky, and it's the only time we'll ever play it, too.
So you think if you'd had formal music training, you would never gone there the first time?
I'd have never gone there in the first place. But we had, honest, I'm not lying to you, that sounds like a story, but there were seven people. We had seven. And that's Flat, that's the Flat and the Osborne Brothers.
Yeah, when there are more band members than audience members, that's never a good thing.
Never a good thing. Never a good thing. Mm-hmm. We've all been there, but there's always some reason. But in this case, the advertisement was out. Everything was there. Everything was good. But we had seven people. I'll never forget it.
But you got to play the show, right?
Oh, we played, yeah. We did the show. Those seven, their money, I mean, they paid their money just like
that's
everybody
right.
else.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah.
So,
yeah.
They don't deserve you to say, well, they're not a big crowd, so we're gone.
Right.
Just shut down.
Well, listen, I know, Kristen, you got to do your stuff at home and get ready to go out to play in the Opry tonight, right?
Yeah, we're playing the 7:30 slot, and that'll be Central Time.
Central Time, okay.
Yeah, are you just playing tonight? 7:30?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Now I know you're going to listen, though, and that makes me nervous.
I will.
Yeah, I know you will. We always text. After we play the Opry, we always get a text from Sonny, a critique.
I'm not going to say what I say, but I have a good time doing that.
It's part of the ritual. I enjoy that.
So how's your new fiddle player?
Oh, he's good. We have Steve, a brand new fiddle player since the record came out, Adam Haynes, and he's working out great.
Oh, yeah.
Great personally and musically. He's just fits us like a glove, so it's all good.
Does he look good?
Does he look good?
Yeah.
Yeah, he looks like the rest of us.
Uh-huh, good.
He looks right in. Yeah.
Did Terry put him in them long shirts and all that stuff?
Yeah, he's been grascalized.
Grascalized, that's a good word.
I don't know what term it would mean, but those kinds of shirts, yeah.
Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy.
They don't have those sparkly blue jackets like you guys did, Sonny.
No, but for them, well, anybody.
Yeah, those things were expensive.
Yeah, they were, but they paid off.
Yeah, it did.
They paid off, so.
Well,
listen, I'll listen to you at 7:30.
Okay.
Can I?
Always good to talk to you, Sonny.
I wish I could meet and have dinner with you or something like that, but I can't. I'm kind of beyond motivation right now.
Sure.
I can't motivate. That's it.
Okay. Sure. Right. I understand.
Well,
all right.
Listen, man. Sonny, as always, thank you for being around. And Kristen, I've enjoyed this thoroughly. Thanks so much for taking time out of your day. I know you're busy. You have family issues. You have a family. You don't have family issues, but you have a family. You're right after a holiday, and you're busy as heck.
I have family issues, too.
we don't have time for that.
No,
we don't have time for that.
No, they're good.
So the new album is phenomenal. I've played a couple cuts from it all over when I get my pay. It's great. Great stuff. So it's going to do well. It's
okay.
Going to do well. Thanks so much
to
both of you. All right.
Take care.
Thank you so much.
All right. I'll talk to you later. Bye bye.
All right. Bye bye.
Bye. Kristen Scott. There. That was fun. That was fun. Once I get everything worked out, sometimes we drop phone calls, but we know they're out there somewhere. So that was Kristen Scott Benson and Sonny Osborne. And as normal, we just let those things run until they kind of run their course, and what a wonderful relationship between them musically and also just as friends. Just a wonderful thing that we got to peek in on, and I'm so glad that you all got to share with me. And this is fun. I'm a lucky guy.